Thanks, Joseph.
Now, I want to just go back through a few of the things you went through. When we talk about Xi Jinping, we often talk about him, as you referred to him, as a princeling, so-called red nobility. That gives the impression superficially that he had a sort of a sheltered, pampered upbringing, but in fact, it's the opposite of the case. He's age 9 when his father was purged, age 14 when he was subjected, denounced in struggle sessions and the like. So just expand a little bit for us on that and why that made him the person that he is today. Did it give him values, or did it simply harden him?
So two answers to that question. The first is that Xi Jinping has always fetishized toughness, and he talks about how his experiences as a sent-down youth turned him into, from a sort of young and soft student from Beijing, into somebody who had gone through constantly being bit by ticks, very, very tough physical labor, saying nothing could ever have been as hard as that. And he would even mention to certain writers from that generation who would describe their sent down youth experiences as having been an unmitigated disaster. And Xi Jinping said, well, you know, actually, I'm a little bit different from you, because for me, it was something that made me better, because it was a process of struggle, right? And this idea of struggle, I think, is a very interesting element of the Chinese political culture. We've seen Xi Jinping talk a lot about struggle publicly over the last few years. And it has to do with this idea that if you stay dedicated to the cause, even after you go through these moments of doubt, after you personally suffer, you not only show how much you care about the CCP, but it even makes you more personally dedicated to it, right? So the other thing about princelings, though, that I think is very interesting is that Xi Jinping has some commonalities with this group, but has also positioned himself as separate from them in other ways as well. So princelings have always been a sort of very sensitive political topic in the CCP. Mao Zedong called them a disaster. And he was afraid that they would manifest in all of the things that he didn't want the CCP to become, right? Elitism, enjoying privileges, separation from the masses. So he was always constantly expressing worry about this group, which helps explain why Xi Zhongxun, the father of Xi Jinping, was such a, as we now know, a real brutal disciplinarian in the home, right? And this is something that Xi Jinping would keep coming back to, saying that whenever other families would see the Xi kids, they would know that it was they were from the Xi family, because they were dressed the most like bumpkins, so to speak, right?
Yeah, that's another part of it. His father was, in one of your papers, you say, at home, he was almost inhuman. I mean, we're a long way from cuddling koalas here, right? So he was really tough father.
So Xi Zhongxun said that what he took most pride in his son Xi Jinping was the toughness. Right, that he even said to Xi Jinping, Xi Jinping's younger brother, that your brother is different from you, because you know, he has gone through these sort of trials and tribulations and come out on the other side harder. And Xi Zhongxun is interesting too, because this is someone who used to brag to people that Deng Xiaoping was persecuted by his own party 3 times, and I was persecuted 5 times. Right, Mao Zedong used to give these pithy aphorisms to characterize people. The one he gave to Xi Jinping's father was, the party's interests come first, right? This is a guy who in 1935, Xi Zhongxun, was nearly buried alive by other members of the CCP. He suffered for 16 years during the Mao era, which was longer than most other people. And when he came out, when he would talk to people who were complaining, he would say, but I bet you didn't have manacles on your arms like I did, or I bet you weren't in solitary for quite as long as I was. It's sort of like, I have the legitimacy to speak out and tell you not to stop whining, because look what I went through, right? But it wasn't like a complaining thing. It was almost this sort of pride thing that, again, has to do with this sort of curious struggle, political culture that the CCP has always fetishized.
It's a little bit like medieval Catholicism or something. Hair shirt quite doesn't get it, I think, there, actually. But in other words, you suffer and you suffer and you suffer, and as a result, in theory, you become a better communist.
Exactly, and we see when Xi Jinping talks about Leninism, he talks about the party, he warns people that this is not like an organization of like-minded people who come together and happen to have similar views, so why don't we sort of plan in a sort of spirit of openness what the party should do, but that this is the party for him is an organizational weapon, right? And it's effective precisely because people at the top who, the way he describes the nature of the system, can be divorced by any special interest and therefore push the party and the people in it beyond what would be possible if these people were proceeding from trying to make a buck or, you know, make it a career. He really sees it sort of as ideals and conviction and motivation is something that he keeps returning to when he talks about how he understands the Leninist Party and where he wants it to go and what he wants it to become.
Because in one of your papers, and you touched on it a bit there, you talk about his toughness, his idealism, his pragmatism, and his cautiousness. Now, we get the toughness, but the idealism is not a word that springs to mind when I think of Xi Jinping. But I think when you say idealism in that context, you mean something different, right?
When I say idealism, I mean that one of the really outstanding shticks sort of Xi Jinping, looking at his entire life, is that he keeps coming back to this theme that the party can really only survive if people in the party believe in it, right? And as I was saying earlier, this is someone who, at least in all of his public pronouncements, and I think sort of makes sense when we think about his generation, is someone whose source of meaning in life is the party, because he sees, I think, really believes this, that the party is the only force in Chinese history that can sort of arrest these centrifugal forces, unite the Chinese people, and overcome these challenges. And in terms of caution, as I was saying, one of the reasons people were so surprised by him was because before he became the top leader, people would go up to him, according to my interviews, and, you know, tell him their views, and they would think that he agreed with them, although he would never be quite explicit about it. And some Chinese historians have theorized that that might have had to do with the fact that his youth, for so long, he was, again, in very vulnerable situations, right, where you need to read people, you don't want to go too far ahead of where you are, you know, of other people. And then in the 1980s, several of his sort of patrons, both in Hebei and then Fujian province, were removed from the leadership by conservatives in Beijing who thought that they were too pro-reform, right? So you don't want to get... And so then in the 90s and 2000s, during these debates about socialism and capitalism, he had a sort of studiously non-ideological approach, right? Where he would say, we shouldn't ask whether it's socialist or capitalist or not. We should ask whether it works or not. But to the extent that they are market mechanisms, we should recognize that these can create forces in society that have bad economic implications, but also bad political implications. So he's always talked about communism as something that's sort of far into the future, that we can't make the mistakes of the Mao era by trying to go too far too quickly. He's always sort of had a very negative impression of dogmatists or people that he associates with book learning. So again, he has, and, but this pragmatism side, of course, in certain ways can conflict with this idealism conviction side and also phobia of chaos side. So this is someone, I think, who has these sort of competing motivations that for people on the outside sometimes don't make sense together, but as someone who is a politician, I think can hold these at the same time and in specific political situations can be sort of creative about what is the most immediately effective approach.
I mean, on another part of that, the suspicion of quote-unquote book learning, as you say, he entered university in 1978. He went to Tsinghua, which is, you know, like Stanford or Harvard in China, something like that. He, you know, one of the sort of fairest things in theory in China is the high school entrance exam where you actually test into university. But he got in as a part of the worker, soldier, peasant.
He didn't test in.
And so people looked down on him in some respects. Some people in China, they don't say it too loudly these days, looked down on him a little as not too smart, not too bright.
So what's interesting is, in this sense, I feel that Mao Zedong and Xi Jinping have a little bit in common, right? Which was, Mao was very well educated, but his learning also wasn't super systematic. But Mao also had always sort of had this shtick of being the person who had more practical experience. And what's interesting here, too, is that in the 1940s in Yan'an, There were these individuals from Moscow, right, who were a bit of a threat, political threat to Mao Zedong.
Yan'an's the revolutionary base.
The revolutionary base. And so the rectification process there was tied up with a version of party history according to which Mao was always fighting these dogmatists and these leftists, but he was the practical guy, and that's why he came out on top. And what's interesting is he tied himself to Xi Zhongxun, the father of Xi Jinping, as their experiences in the Northwest, because Mao was from the Southeast from before the Long March, which ended in the Northwest, which is where Xi Zhongxun had been a revolutionary. That when Xi Zhongxun was persecuted in 1935, he said, Xi Zhongxun's persecution in 1935 was just like how I was treated from before the Long March. He also was targeted by these sort of dogmatists from Moscow who read these books and didn't really understand. So Xi Jinping has sort of similarly told a story of himself as recognizing that you need to have like an idea, you need to, like Marxism is something that we need to study, but also has said that what makes China great is Marxism was cynicized and that, you know, we can innovate. So it's a way of saying that both having this idea of motivating people with ideals and conviction by talking about communism in one way, but also not feeling that we need to be entirely dogmatic in terms of how we move forward. But again, those can sometimes conflict, but not always.
But is he resentful of the fact that he didn't have a proper education? Does he sort of resent the... One of the great swear words of global politics is the elite.
Well, this
is he resentful of the so-called elite in China?
Well, I think that, as I was saying before, Xi Jinping's level of education has been a sore point, right? So at Tsinghua, he would have been there at the same time that the Gaokao, the examination students, would have been there.
Like the really bright students.
We know the Gaokao people sort of look down on them a little bit, right? And we know that one of the things that upset the leadership in the early years of Xi Jinping's tenure was this comment by one of the sons of Hu Yaobang. So Hu Yaobang was a very famous sort of pro-reform general secretary in the 1980s. And one of his sons made a comment about Xi Jinping's education at a meeting of Yanhuang Chunqiu, which is a very famous party history journal that sort of pushed the envelope in terms of what they could say that was later sort of... It's still there, but it was essentially taken over by more hardline conservatives. And Li Rei, this individual who I mentioned earlier, this secretary to Mao Zedong, on his deathbed, he was saying, I don't understand why Xi Jinping ended up being the person that he was. I knew his father so well. I want you to go and investigate how something like this could have happened. And then he made another sort of derogatory comment about Xi Jinping's education, saying, I didn't expect that actually his education was so low. But he did go to Tsinghua. He later on wrote a dissertation. I've read the dissertation. He seems to be a sort of autodidact. And a lot of these cultural revolution sent down youth, they had nothing to do in the countryside, right? So they read a lot, right? But, you know, it wouldn't have been a sort of systematic thing, right, which has to do, again, with this thing of saying, it's because I learned myself and I was questioning and I came back to it, you know, this thing that he keeps talking about, too. But it's conjecture, but there's a reason to believe that it would be something he doesn't love hearing, right? So
let's just go to another stage of his career. Once again, we go back to the red nobility thing. People think, oh, yes, it was a smooth path for him. Mm. Whereas, in fact, he did what just about every Chinese leader has to do. He went outside of Beijing. He went to Fujian province, not a poor province, but a poor part of Fujian province. Mm-hmm. And he was an official in Fujian for 18 years. Mm-hmm. But this is the stage where I think maybe you think of him as cautious. In other words, he sort of stays within the boundaries of the zeitgeist, mm-hmm. be it socialist, capitalist, or whatever, mm-hmm. and sort of plots a path forward. Mm. How would you describe that? You know, is that what you mean by cautious?
So you mentioned princelings, right? And you also mentioned that the princeling handle has always been sort of a good thing and a bad thing for him, right? So in the 1980s, there was this very interesting meeting, actually chaired by Li Rei. He was working at the organization department at the time, of a lot of princelings, and the discussion was whether or not there was going to be a very, like a special document managing the princelings, precisely because they were so unpopular within society, because of this view that they were benefiting from being related to these top-ranking officials. And what's interesting is these princelings were like, it's so hard to be a princeling. People will say when you do something good, oh, you're not like the other princelings, you're down to earth, or you're not like the other princelings, you actually work hard. I wish I wasn't a princeling, right? But at the same time, they had this sense of the regime as being their own, right? This sense of being special and an inheritance. And there is this quote by the son of Chunyuan, a very famous revolutionary and sort of the second highest leader during the 1980s after Deng Xiaoping. His son said, the ruling class needs to have the consciousness of a ruling class, right? So they were both benefiting, but also they were unpopular at the same time. And this shaped Xi Jinping's trajectory a little bit too, right? So his first job after graduating from Tsinghua was with Geng Biao, a defense official. And Geng Biao's daughter went to go work for Xi Zhongxun. It was partly facilitated by the Ye family, the family of Ye Jianing. So one of Ye Jianing's sons went to work for Xi Zhongxun in Guangdong too. And then when Xi Zhongxun wrote a letter, actually, when Xi Jinping was working in Fujian, Xi Zhongxun wrote a letter to the party boss of Hebei saying something along the lines of, I hope you keep an eye out for my son. And it was basically a request for nepotism in a way, right? And this, the party boss of Hebei, this guy named Gao Yang, he read the letter at a local party meeting, and it was so humiliating that Xi Jinping had to be transferred to Fujian, right?
So that's why he ended up, because his father tried to place him in a senior position, and the official refused to do it and was furious about the pressure being put on him.
So here we see a high-ranking official trying to help their son, but also with backfiring, right? So Xi Jinping also said, you know, like, I was purged so much, I mean, my father was purged so much earlier than all of the other princelings, right? So he suffered even more for the fact that he was a princeling than others. There was this incident in 1985, right? He also, as I said, used to talk about my family was even more frugal than other families in the 1950s and that kind of thing, talking about how I rededicated to my cause in the 1980s when the other princelings wanted to have fun, right? So this thing of the idea of princelings, I think, we have to keep in mind that it was a double-edged sword for them, and that they also try to differentiate among themselves, and they have different views, and that it has to get to this feeling of both entitlement, but also vulnerability at the same time.
Yes, I mean, there's the old saying that, you know, 10 families run China, or somebody says 80 families run China, 100 families. I can't keep up, really. But that's what they're talking about, that this inner core of resilient privilege and vulnerability, which is sustained until today?
I think that's right. And I think one other thing to keep in mind here is that...
And they're all in Beijing, too. They're all the families, and the privileged families are in Beijing.
Yeah, I mean, this. Keep in mind, again, with regards to Xi Jinping, I think he came to power with this idea that corruption... right, was a big threat, and this also gets tied in a little bit to this idea that one of the reasons the party was so vulnerable was that people were losing their dedication to the cause, and this gets into, I think, his distaste for materialism and hedonism and that kind of thing, and how he's positioned himself as being different from those other individuals. But what's interesting is... about Xi Jinping is that if you look at the sort of public discourse from the propaganda apparatus, they do talk about how the fact that Xi Jinping is the son of Xi Zhongxun makes him a good person to be the top leader, because just even the style of the household where he would learn about frugality, would learn about the revolution, you know, made him to be who he was and why he's so, according to this narrative, great at what he does. Well, at the same time, you have people like Li Rei or other intellectuals saying, you know, your father was such and such and such and such. You're being unfilial by acting in this particular way. Xi Jinping is not the son of Xi Zhongxun, but the grandson of Mao Zedong, right? So people constantly use this family politics either to legitimate him or use it as political weapons against him.
So we've got too much to talk about. So just before we go to audience questions... once he comes to office, he's not cautious. He has this massive anti-corruption campaign addressed at real corruption, but also locking up his enemies. Mm-hmm. He locks up liberals. He takes on the United States like no other Chinese leader has. Now, there's all sorts of reasons for that and the like. He's the absolute opposite of cautious. So
a couple things about that. The first is there was an article in The Atlantic recently that said that Chinese politics are becoming unpredictable because Xi Jinping can no longer be restrained by collective leadership. But that, I think, is a fundamental misunderstanding of the Deng era, right? So Deng Xiaoping, who was the main leader for the 1980s, was seen as this hero who installed these post-Mao guardrails. But based on all of this new evidence coming out shows that...
So remember, CCP, just to say, one of the key guardrails is term limits,
right?
Which Xi Jinping has gotten rid of.
But if we now know, based on more evidence that's coming out of the Deng era, that the CCP has always been an extraordinarily leader-friendly system, and that Deng Xiaoping himself thought that the CCP only functioned and, in fact, was superior to other systems because it had a core, and he was the core, which meant that he got to make up his own mind. So the stuff about Xi Jinping being more unpredictable and sort of a break with the past, well, Deng Xiaoping engineered a war against Vietnam that happened in 1979, even though the planning for that took place before he was the top leader. In 1984, he went south to inspect the special economic zones. Nobody knew whether he was going to approve them or criticize them, and they were sort of shocked and pleased, the people in the south that he visited, when he liked what he saw. 1988, Deng Xiaoping executed price reform in a way that was so disastrous, almost sunk reform and opening. 1989, Deng was almost the only person in the leadership who wanted a violent crackdown on the students, and he got it. 1992, the Southern Tour, when reform and opening was restarted, Deng didn't have a single formal position. Xi Jinping, arguably, has not made a decision as drastic or as devastating as some of those key moments that I just described during the Deng era, right? As I've said, Xi Jinping,
you're saying he's much more constrained than people say, than it looks from the outside.
I wouldn't say constrained, but I would also say that as someone with the kind of experience that he does, and someone who doesn't want to accidentally destroy the regime by making choices that risk stability in fundamental ways, but also we've seen that there's certainly cases of overreach, but the system isn't completely incapable of course correction either, right? And so you talked about him sort of, arresting these liberals and that kind of thing. We don't know for sure, but if I had to guess, I would think that Xi Jinping thinks of himself as someone who isn't going to make the mistakes of the Mao era, the radical Mao era. And I think that actually the party history decision was a way of signaling to people who wanted a reversal of the Cultural Revolution verdict that that's not going to happen, but also saying that there were real problems that happened in reform and opening, not because reform and opening was wrong, but that it created these forces in society that only I can address by strengthening the party and sort of disciplining the party. So again, just the way he's formulating what he's doing, he's emphasizing continuity sort of as much as possible. And in terms of continuity and discontinuity, we also need to look at what particular policy area we're talking about, right? So if you read how people were talking about the late Hu Jintao era, people were complaining about him being really hardline as well, right? And a lot of the sort of foreign policy ambition happened soon after the global financial crisis, right? So this idea of periodization, I think, is inherently political, either in terms of like a legitimation or an anti-legitimation narrative, and that it's more useful, I think, to focus on sort of specific policy areas and sort of be cautious about sort of sweeping statements. And again, also because there's some capacity for course correction, and he hasn't made these huge mistakes that Deng did either, I feel.
Yeah, we haven't even mentioned Xinjiang, but we don't have time to get into that today, but that's a hardline policy. Now, just very finally, briefly, you're sort of emphasizing, I think, continuity rather than disruption. But what about he stays on in power 5 more years, maybe in perpetuity, leader for life, however you want to phrase it? Mm. Does that start to stretch the system?
Yeah, so there were
people were very angry about that.
Yeah.
China.
So first of all, I want to stress that the CCP is not a popularity contest, right? So this is not a system where coalitions compete freely and you win because your policy wins the most support, or that you're automatically punished for incompetence. Xi Jinping can draw upon all kinds of things to assert dominance and get what he wants. But I also want to say that we know very little about how decisions are made now. But one piece of crucial context, I think, is that there were multiple Mao Zedongs, right? So as I was saying earlier, for many years, Mao legitimately could claim to have been someone within the party who proceeded from a very practical, flexible, sort of clever position, but he changed a lot, right? And part of that, I think, had to do with hubris, right? Because when you're that dominant for so long, it's easy for your things to sort of go to your head, right? So just as there were multiple Mao Zedongs, there could be multiple Xi Jinpings, and the longer he's in power, the more aggressive and ambitious he may become. But also we know that Xi Jinping, when he talks about ideology, he sees China in a contest with the West in a way that opponents of the system from the outside, because they can't accept a powerful communist competitor, will become more brazen in terms of attempts to ideologically penetrate and weaken and achieve a so-called peaceful evolution, colored revolution in China, the more powerful that China gets, which suggests that he sees the ideological element, the ideological contest getting more intense, the stronger that China gets, because the West will become more brazen as they try to resist that. So things could change.
Okay, thank you. Questions? And please say your name, and let's keep it to questions, not statements. Down the front. I think we've got a microphone coming for you.
Trevor Rowe, interesting comments about Xi Jinping. I met him a couple of times. And he's very stern, but he does have a sense of humour. But I understand from my time in, I lived up in Hong Kong for 15 years in the 90s, and I understand from my friends that his attitude towards the West, particularly the United States, was very much influenced by a guy called Wang Huiming, as you know, when they wrote the book America Against America and the like. And I understand his influence is starting to wane. Is that, can you confirm that?
Just explain who Wang Huiming is.
Yeah, so Wang Huiming is a prominent intellectual who used to be a professor, but who has sort of climbed the ranks within the Chinese system and is now the so-called ideology czar. And he's a very interesting person.
And he's on the top leadership group.
Yeah, he's a very interesting person for several reasons. The first is that his career trajectory was so unique. And he wrote this book called America Against America. It was based on his travels there, and it's a sort of very conservative formulation, this idea that you need to have traditional values. You need, to have, like, a belief in something. You need to have a respect for authority. And this is all stuff that I've been talking about that, based on Xi Jinping's own background, very clearly he would find something there that, he would like, right? I don't know about whether Wang Huning's star is rising or falling, but I will provide one other sort of interesting anecdote to you. So Xi Zhongxun, right, as I was saying earlier, a lot of people saw him as this reformist, right? It's sort of a quintessentially liberal, humane wing of the party. But Xi Zhongxun visited, well, he visited Australia in 1979, but he also visited the United States in 1980. And he visited a place called the Amana Colonies in Iowa. And it's an interesting place because it was created by this religious group and everybody lived communally. But then they decided that they wanted to split up and have their own plots. And this was when Xi Zhongxun was party boss of Guangdong, and it was as China was shifting away from collectivization to the so-called household responsibility system. This is one of the sort of key innovations of China's reform, but Xi Zhongxun opposed it, right? So he supported the special economic zones, but he did not support this, you know, really fundamental change in agriculture, which challenges, I think, this easy differentiation of conservatives and reformers. But when Xi Zhongxun visited the Amana colony, as they were describing to him that they decided that they wanted to split up, Xi Zhongxun became very animated and was sort of grilling the tour guide, like, well, what happened to society? What happened to culture? What happened to differences in income? Like, why did they break up? Why wasn't it working? You're sort of puzzled and befuddled that after they had achieved it for so long. And Wang Huiming, in his book, America Against America, writes about the Amana colonies in sort of similar ways about how one of the reasons the Amana colonies fell apart is because they cared about their immediate individual materialistic interests and they lost the sort of ideological superstructure of united values that is the only kind of thing that can allow experiments like that to function. It's not really an answer to your question, but I tried to give you something interesting about Huang Huining anyways. So,
Changi, first down the front, then over there, then.
Yes, Feng Songyi from University of Technology, Sydney. I love your juicy details as a historian, but I want to bring you to a big picture. From my perspective, the unique position of Xi Jinping is the one communist leader who did something very special. If you look at the evolution of China, or communist regimes, most of them, Soviet Union and East Europe, European regimes, when the revolutionary old guard disappear, they evolve into from totalitarian rule or totalitarian regime to post-totalitarian regime after the death of Stalin. Okay. And then they may get into democratization or democratic transition with success or failure. And then there's one unique case is North Korea. They never went into this post-totalitarian. In China, they followed roughly the Soviet Union model that after the death of Mao, and then involved into post-totalitarianism. And then after 3 decades or 4 decades of post-totalitarianism, Xi Jinping came in to reverse the process. To engage in this new process of the totalitarianization. That's the unique position. Do you have an explanation of this?
Yeah, so my book came out in May, which is about successions after Mao and Stalin, so I'll have to be careful in terms of how long my answer is, but everyone can maybe buy the book if they want the really long answer. But so there used to be this idea that after Stalin and Mao died, there was a victory of collective leadership. There was this contest between reformers and conservatives, and as a process of sort of coalition within the party who wanted change, won out, and then there was this shift to a new constrained version of politics. But what I think the new evidence shows that in both the Soviet and the Chinese cases, it was actually more of a story of failed collective leadership. And that what happened was both Khrushchev and Deng essentially saw themselves as individuals who shouldn't and wouldn't listen to the views of other people within the top leadership. And ultimately, in 1964, Khrushchev was pushed out not because his policies were unpopular so much as because people like Brezhnev thought that Khrushchev was going to come for them first. And they were concerned that they couldn't win because Khrushchev still had so many strengths. And they were just like, "This, we just have to try something," essentially, right? And Deng, as I was talking about earlier, this is someone who had Bo Yibo, the father of Bo Xilai, go to others in the leadership and say, "The party can only have one mother-in-law. I'm that mother-in-law." Chen Yun would go up to Zhao Ziyang, general secretary of the party, and say, "Why don't we have meetings?" And Zhao would say, "Well, you need to go talk to Deng about that. I'm just a secretary," meaning that Deng didn't want to have meetings because he didn't want to listen to what Chen had to say. And there was all these, as I said, just sudden choices in the policy sphere that people didn't expect, that sometimes were good and sometimes were bad. So I think that we don't know a lot about what was going on in the Jiang Zemin or Hu Jintao eras. But the fact that this has always been a system that had mechanisms and tools whereby a motivated leader could reassert real dominance never really went away. And people like Hu Yaobang had hoped that Deng Xiaoping would be a George Washington. That's actually Hu Yaobang's own words, that he would create actually vibrant and robust institutions for decision-making and restraining leaders. But that didn't happen. I think that left this ability for Xi Jinping to
unwind
to
them.
Do what he did.
Yeah.
To the extent they ever existed, of course.
Okay, so let's take two questions at once now. And we'll come to you next, but we're running out of time. One, then two, and keep your questions short, okay, because we're running out of time.
Based on what you said, it would seem inconceivable that Xi would want to take action against Taiwan, such high-risk thing. But if and when they did, or what would the Chinese Communist Party's rhetoric be? What would their narrative be that justified killing people they say are Chinese people and also losing their own armed forces as well?
Okay, and over here, we're going to do the two at once.
Hi, my name is Eric Ma. I just want to ask, can you talk about how and why Xi Jinping was chosen as the successor during the Hu era, and were people who chose him surprised by his later actions? Thank you.
Wonderful questions, of course. On Taiwan, as I was alluding to earlier, Xi Jinping is someone who has multiple sort of centers of gravity, sort of multiple different inclinations, and that what he does when he faces any particular moment or policy issue, there will be a very significant level of contingency as he looks at the situation and thinks about, you know, his own sort of views more broadly on that particular question. With regards to Taiwan, I think it's particularly hard to read because this is someone for whom the Taiwan issue is extraordinarily emotional, right? So his father was a famous United Front guy who managed the KMT for a lot of the Civil War and then rebuilt the United Front on the 1980s as one of his primary tasks on the Secretariat, which was targeted against Taiwan, right? And was involved in some of those very sort of interesting discussions and sort of back-channel communications with the Taiwanese. And again, Xi Jinping is someone who believes in Chinese civilization, believes in people who believe in something, right? And so he had this very revealing comment to Ma Ying-jeou, where he told Ma Ying-jeou that Angela Merkel said to him, you know, when we Germans...
Former Taiwanese president.
Excuse me. Angela Merkel said to him, Xi Jinping, you know, when we Germans lose territory, that's it. We don't worry about it after. Why can't you Germans be like us?
Why can't you Chinese
be more like us Germans? And Xi Jinping said, we Chinese are not like you Germans. What is bequeathed to us by our forebears, we will never give up, right? And for someone who has like such a sense of mission, right? Like you can imagine just how big of a deal Taiwan is for him. But at the same time, he's probably not someone who wants to take risks so big that would put the regime at risk, right? So he would have to be, I think, very sure. The danger with Taiwan now is when you have a situation where if you can tell a story within your own system that sooner or later our situation will get better, then you can be patient. But if it looks like things are moving drastically in a worse direction, you may feel like you need to act in a way that could be very destabilizing. And for the West, the question is, you know, after the Russian war against Ukraine, there's a recognition authoritarian regimes do what they can get away with and makes the Taiwan issue even more, you know, prominent. But to do that without, creating a full-blown, you know, crisis scenario. And I'm not getting paid enough to figure out how to do that. So that's something for all of you to discuss. With regards to how Xi Jinping came to power, so the Xi Jinping ascension was quite interesting, right? Because Deng Xiaoping picked both of his two successors after him, right? So Deng Xiaoping picked Jiang Zemin and he picked Hu Jintao. So this stuff about there being like institutions, right? Like, well, actually the only time someone was selected in a way other than Deng Xiaoping picking them was Xi Jinping. So there might have been some kind of, you know, discussion, communication, straw polling, semi-democratic. We don't know what it was like, but it would have been something that Deng didn't choose, which raises a lot of questions in terms of what the imprimatur was, what the expectations were, what kinds of things people were talking about. But I want to emphasize that you can collect versions of how he came to power, right? In fact, you could make a coffee table book of different versions of the ascension of Xi Jinping and why he was picked as his successor. And then you could sort of like rip out each page as you sort of get closer and closer to the real answer, but the real answer might not actually be in that coffee book yet. It's just a very sort of mysterious thing. And but the fact that, as I said, at least the liberal intelligentsia in Beijing were quite shocked by who he became. But at the same time, there probably were people in the system who thought that a stronger hand was necessary to bring things together. But then again, as I was saying, because it's not a popularity contest, you can do a lot of what you think is right, whether or not you think a lot of people agree with you when you're sitting in that chair.
Final question up the back.
Sorry. So I still have a chance. In fact, you answered some of the questions about, according to his history, his experience and personality, regarding of Taiwan towards, for his next leadership, how you looking at his attitude? Also looking at the Western world, particularly including the U.S.?
You meaning what is his future agenda? What is his top priorities? That kind of thing. Yeah, I think we know. I think we have a good sense, right? Like as I said, people change, and he could become more ambitious as time goes on. But I would be surprised if the upcoming Congress, and I'm really getting into conjecture, sort of signaled some fundamental shift or new shift, or his sort of model for leading would move in a sort of rapidly different direction. Richard, maybe you have more thoughts on this, but I wouldn't be surprised if the 20th Congress didn't have big surprises, I guess, would be one way of putting it.
Yes, well, every five-year party Congress has always big surprises. I guess the big surprises this year have been from the outside. It's COVID zero.
Yeah.
It's Ukraine.
Yeah.
We haven't had an internal explosion yet like we had in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that'll be come in terms of whether he names a successor or a couple of successors.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the surprise so far is there's no surprise internally, but, you know, at some stage, I think the biggest, you know... COVID. He did a lot of enemies, yeah, or critics, we might be gentle. Yeah, enemies and critics, yeah, and they're struggling with that. Look, I think we have to end there. I can see the time here. It's gone into negative. It's minus 44 seconds, which means that I have to... Joseph, thank you very much for that. I'm sure that we could be here for hours. I very appreciate it.